You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds. Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, hosted by Aaron Fifield.
What's up, traders? Welcome to episode number 71. Thank you very much for tuning in. A big guest on the podcast this week, a man who for many won't need any introduction, and that is Eric Scott Hunsader. Eric started out as an algorithmic trader in the early 80s, soon after became a self-taught programmer, and since then he's written many software applications for financial data. But today, Eric is the founder of Nanex, a whole market streaming data feed which transmits 20 billion data points every day. Well known for speaking out against the many issues that surround high-frequency trading, Eric will tell you straight. HFT firms are stealing money, exchanges have rigged the market, and the regulators that allow this type of activity to continue are corrupt individuals. So as you can imagine, this makes for some really interesting conversation. Additionally, we talk about quote stuffing, many flash crashes that are occurring on a daily basis, and why Eric recently received a $750,000 whistleblower award from the SEC. Now, this interview is a real opener, and I'm excited to share it with you. I'm Aaron Fifield, and here is Eric Hunsader. Eric, it's incredible to be speaking with you. How's it going, man?
It's going fine, mate.
I like it. Well, thank you very much for being here. Let's get right into it because I certainly have a lot of questions for you, mostly around market microstructure and, of course, HFT. But before we get too deep into that, I'm keen to know how you got to where you are now. So let's start from where you began programming because you've been labeled as one of the most gifted programmers in the United States by The Guardian. Where did you learn from and how did you get into programming?
Well, I started in 84, they weren't really teaching programming languages in college. It wasn't mainstream at all. So I taught myself. Got a book called C Primer Plus, written by Stephen Waite, who, by the way, later became a customer of mine about 15 years later, but that's beside the point. Anyway, I bought his book. Really went through the entire C language, and I devoured it. I mean, I read through the whole thing in just a couple days and really enjoyed writing code. And actually, the reason I wanted to learn computer programming languages because I had my own algorithm in a Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet calculating 30-minute oscillators for the S&P 500 futures, which I would then call in to down on the floor when the signals went off. And that wasn't fast enough to run optimization. So I turned to see how I could do it faster, and that led me to need to program, and C seemed to be the best language. And I started that in 84, and I have not stopped.
That's very cool. Now, do you still use C for the most part to this day?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Now, So you mentioned that you had some interest in trading, as you'd already created an algorithm before 84. Where did that interest in trading and finance come from?
The Wall Street Journal. Just fascinated by that whole world, how you could be independent and create a living with not having to hire a lot of people. It was a way to kind of get to do something on your own that was exciting.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think that's what, obviously attracts a lot of people to trading. And, it really sort of draws on that entrepreneurial streak that many of us have. So what was your experience like, in those first few years trading? From what I understand, you're not an active trader still to this day. So how long did that last for?
It lasted about 2.5 years. And it was during that time that it was actually quite profitable. And, enough to make a living off of and enough to buy more computers. And it was also during this time that I really developed a love, if you will, for writing software and not so much of a love for following the system, because I would always second guess it. Writing software will always do what you tell it to do, day in and day out, whereas trading, there's a lot of unknowns that you can't account for. And I just decided that I was going to learn how to write or get better at writing code, and I would come back to trading one day. And I never did. And so it was at the same time I was developing the system, I was also archiving the data that I was using in the system, which was, the futures data from the CME, which, by the way, I was able to archive on a 360K floppy disk, the entire exchange trading for the day, and started selling that data to other people who wanted to develop algos and, created a bulletin board system and sold the data online. This was quite a bit before the internet, where people had to dial up. And, that business was actually taking off and bringing in income. And so it was a pretty easy decision to say, hey, you know what? I'll come back to trading later in life.
Sure. So is that how Nanex came to be today, or did you have any other roles in the finance world or even
more? Oh, no. Nanex didn't come along until the year 2000. So this, around 89, One of my customers who was buying data from me was a man by the name of Tom Joseph, who runs Trading Techniques in Ohio. And him and I really got along, and he wanted me to write software for his company. And I thought that was a great opportunity. And so I took it, and I went to work for him. And we did great things. I remember we were riding around in his Cadillac with an old compact computer hooked up to a cell phone modem thing. It was a big brick, but we had real time streaming charts, mobile, to watch the S&P 500 futures. And so, I wrote a lot of software back in those days. That a lot of it. We were doing Windows kind of stuff before Windows even came along. So that when the next iteration of software came down the pike, it was, we were always iterative and learning on top of the knowledge base that we had built up before. So then it was a few years doing that, a company called CQG, which is still a company around today, they bought Tom's software and wanted me to come along with it. So I did, because Windows had just come out and they wanted to port their software over to CQG for Windows. And I thought that was interesting. And so I went to do that. And then about 3 years into that, that's when the internet came along. And people who had been writing software for a while then, we just knew the internet was going to be huge. I mean, it was within a few days of really seeing how things were connected, it was so obvious that this was going to be one of those revolutionary things. And I went to the CEO of CQG, Tim Mather, and I said, "Hey, Tim, I want to do this. This is what we need to do. And if you guys don't want to do it, I want you to, I want to go and do it on my own." And he was cool with that. And so I left and started my own company, and in a very short period of time had written a real-time streaming Java applet that, somebody could type in a symbol and they would get the streaming chart and time and sales. And that was called, we called it Live Charts. And then we had a desktop application that went with it called Q Charts. And Quote.com came along and saw it, and we kind of merged together. They gave me a bunch of stock in return for the software. And so we partnered together, and in the space of 18 months or 2 years, we went from zero to 10,000 paying customers. And so, wow. Which was a novel thing back then, because everybody was giving things away for free. And really the only sites making any money were the dating sites and us. And it was fascinating watching, interacting with people who for the first time ever saw that stock prices actually changed during the day. I mean, so many people had this notion that, the numbers they see in the Wall Street Journal, those closing prints, is the only price for that stock for the day. And so that brought on a whole group of people, day traders who wanted to participate. And this was the, big internet bull market, of course, which made it all the more wild and crazy. And so winding up, Lycos came along and wanted to buy Quote.com out. And actually, what really goes on, that whole IPO business is, the venture capitalists, they want to cash out. I mean, that was what they're always looking at. And it was the term is a liquidity event, where we can turn our worthless stock paper into money. And I was, I was fine with that, and so we got cashed out, and I got a chunk of Lycos stock, and I, knowing how the markets were and how crazy that bubble was, I had it all sold in about 2 weeks, which, at the time, a lot of people were telling me I was being an idiot, but, that was in December of 99, and I guess it was one of my better trades. And that's when I started, founded Nanex, the company.
Okay, sure. So tell us a little bit about Nanex and what you're actually doing today. And by the way, that was really cool to get your backstory. So yeah, give us a little insight to what Nanex does today and, what you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
So, one of the things that I've always been developing over the years, in fact, the code name for the, or what I call Encore now, the data feed, is, I called it Generation 5 because it was the fifth time that I was going to start with a blank sheet of paper and design the ideal ticker plan that so that you could build things on top of it and not have to worry about all of the difficulties that go into putting together a ticker plan, which involves maintenance and databasing and normalization and duplication and then have a nice API on top of it so that writing software for it would be a joy. And so that's what I set out to do in 2000. And I logged the hours, and it was about 25,000 hours later. I had it at a stage where I was comfortable releasing it to my first customer, and that was in 2004. And remembering the crazy times of going from zero to 10,000 paying subscribers, I wanted to do this one a little bit slower and more manageable. So I never advertised it was available. I partnered with a company, by the way, called Data, at the time it was called Data Transmission Network. Now I think they're owned by Schneider, but they're still my partner, and they're essentially, they do all of the non-software related things. They manage the networks, they deal with the exchanges, which is a big part of the equation, the contracts with customers, the billing, everything that's not really related to processing the real-time stream. So by not advertising or wanting to push it, and, you know, I wasn't out to conquer the world and you know, be the king of real-time. I just wanted kind of like build a solid niche that that was proud of, that I could write software on top of. And so by never advertising it, we got a very wide variety of customers using it because they weren't targeted.
Right. Okay. So who are the, you know, you said you've got a wide variety of customers using Ncore. Who are those, like, who are those types of customers? Like, are they big institutional funds who utilize your data, or are they, yes, you know, independent guys? Like,
yes. Yeah. Name me a group and I'll say yes. We got one. We have representation from all groups, including high frequency trading firms who want to, you know, do back testing on it. You know, we have a very unique data set. We pride ourselves in really, you know, drilling down to the issues. In fact, we help the exchanges actually debug some of their issues that they had with the various trade conditions, for example, and whether it sets the higher or lower, or, you know, crazy rules that they have. Whenever something didn't match up, we would track it all the way down to the source to find out exactly why that's not, why this condition is doing X when you have a document doing it Y. And so it's that attention to detail, and also just the joy of working with the API. It really is out of the box. For somebody to work with a data feed, usually there's a long process in understanding all the different ways to parse that data. But with Ncore, it's a really unique experience where an experienced programmer can come along who's written for other data feeds, and within one day we'll totally get it, and we'll be actually getting, you know, getting down to writing what he wants to instead of working with the API, with the actual nuts and bolts of the feed.
Okay. So just so we understand, why is the data that you provide so unique from other data providers that exist to this day?
Well, one, we don't exclude anything. A lot of other data providers will squeeze out the information that they don't feel is necessary. They'll normalize it way before it's supposed to be normalized. And I don't believe in that at all. The other thing is I've developed a real-time compression that drops the size of the information to a 20th of its original size. One of the things that I've specialized over the years in working in software is data compression, data transmission, and graphical interface. So the compression part, I sat down and tried to figure out a way where I could not sacrifice speed, but get the tightest compression possible. And I had been stabbing at it for many, many years in the past. And I finally got a breakthrough that allowed the compression to drop fast, lower and lower than I had expected in the beginning. And as an added bonus, was very fast. And it was so fast that it actually ended up being, back in the day, faster to compress it and transmit it than not to compress it at all because of the serial latency cost on networks. So the data is tiny, but it's rich with all the information within. It's very easy. It's hard to describe, but it has things in it that when programmers see it and use it for the first time, realize the huge advantage that they get. For example, one of the more expensive tasks in dealing with the ticker is taking that symbol and associating it with a memory pointer where you're actually going to start doing some work with it. That association there is usually a pretty expensive process. With our feed, that we've cut that cost down to zero. It's literally no cost to have that instant. You're working with that data immediately, and we save you these important steps along the way. It just makes it easier. You know, unless you're a software guy and you've used it, you won't. It's impossible for me to explain, but the guys who have used it, there's that light bulb moment when they get it. And, you know, usually it's just like, oh, that's brilliant. That's just awesome. And that's the last we hear of them because they don't need our help anymore. I mean, they're off and going.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, your flagship product here, Ncore, I understand it collects around about 6 billion data points each and every day, which is huge.
Well, we're up to 20 billion-ish.
Wow. Okay.
Starting at the beginning of the year, you know, they keep adding options exchanges and they keep developing new option products. And I mean, there's a million different option contracts out there and there's 15 exchanges and, you know, 15 times a million times one quote per second gets you to 15 million a second.
Wow. Okay. So 20 billion data points per day.
Yep.
Can you give us some idea about the infrastructure and server space required to support this data?
Well, it's about a petabyte raw now.
Okay, but, so what's that?
Again, a petabyte, so you have gigabyte, and then 1,000 gigabytes is a terabyte, and then 1,000 terabytes is a petabyte.
Okay, right. And is all that stored locally, or do you use like sort of a cloud system?
We do have some of it in the cloud, some of the more recent data in the cloud, but we have it in triplicate in different locations. It's an onslaught of data that's coming at us every day. You know, it could be a terabyte a day that has to go through the system, and it's automated to check it, to test it, to look for errors and correct those errors. And it's not something you'd be able to develop right away. It's after a lot of experience, you learn the best way to make that flow automatically.
Sure.
You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. They started at the beginning, reimagining the bond screener with an intuitive design that helps you zero in on the exact kinds of bonds you're looking for. Then they made it easier to evaluate each investment opportunity with better data in the places you need it most. Finally, they made investing in bonds as straightforward as stocks or any other asset. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
So let's just change topics here. Let's dive into the subject of high frequency trading. So one of the questions I want to start out with is asking you, when did you first begin to notice HFT activity in the data you were collecting?
Well, I remember looking at, just checking on how the compression was doing and seeing quotes from, certain, I think it was ARCA was the first one I really noticed it on, where it was an obvious pattern where the quote would step up a penny and then down two and then up two, a pattern like that over and over again over a short period of time. And I thought that was interesting, but it wasn't enough for me to like really sound the alarm or it just looked like somebody's testing some system and it's not something that will happen all the time. And then it wasn't until the flash crash came along and, just overwhelmed the data systems throughout Wall Street. The SIP just got crushed that afternoon. And we, my colleague Jeff and I, we saw the SEC wasn't getting anywhere with assembling the data to start processing and seeing what happened. And, the beauty of the NCORE is you can go back to any day and replay that day just like it happened in real time. I mean, where you can see what the options were doing, what the futures were doing, what the ETFs were doing, and the underlyings, all of that, as if you were there on that day. So you can go through scenarios and you can see what the relationships are. And so I remarked to Jeff Donovan, my programmer in California, I said, why don't we spend a week just seeing if we can find anything unusual in the data set? And, oh God, do I regret that. that was going down a rabbit hole that just keeps on going. So it was a very short period of time. We discovered, oh my gosh, look, NYC was 30 seconds late updating the SIP quotes. And we published the first thing that we've ever written, and it got picked up on Zero Hedge, and boom, overnight, people were calling us. Andrei Krylenko from the CFTC, for example, saw it, and he was like, oh, you got to come out to Washington. We want to talk to you. And that's kind of where it all, where the rabbit hole got deeper.
Okay. So, and you do a really great job of explaining that 30-second delay that occurred during the flash crash in the documentary Money and Speed. So I'll make sure to link to that documentary in the show notes. Just want to ask you to explain the SIP, if you could, please.
Well, the SIP is a consolidated feed, man. So what's really unique about the U.S. stock market that I don't think is replicated anywhere else, and God, I hope nobody does, replicates that model, but they sell two data feeds. And one of them is faster than the other, but by law, it's not supposed to be. And so the SIP was supposed to be the only source of real-time information. I mean, written and referenced everywhere in the in Reg NMS, which is the regulation that ushered in high-frequency trading in the U.S. stock market. And so the SIP was being used by a lot of firms for the real-time data, including Goldman Sachs' Sigma X dark pool. Many dark pools were using it. Many exchanges were using it. In fact, the NYC still uses it to this day for knowing where the prices are at the other exchanges. And so the SIP is a consolidated feed, which should be the only feed, but the exchanges also sell direct feeds independently.
Okay, got it. So just before I fire off some more questions about HFT, I think it might be a good idea to ask you, what's your interpretation of HFT? Because I know many people have, slightly different understandings of, the phrase HFT and high frequency trading. So when you speak about HFT, what are you referring to?
Okay, I'm going to make this really simple. HFT is all about electronic trading. And I like to use this phrase, electronic trading brought down costs, high-frequency trading brought down ethics. High-frequency trading is a form of trading that takes zero risk. It results in perfect trading days. It's where you have the sell side already executing at the same time as the buy side is executing. It's risk-free arbitrage, and it can only work if you have collusion with the exchanges. The exchanges are fully aware of what's going on, and because they sell these high-priced data fees, which is what's driving all of their income. And so it's this symbiotic relationship between the high-frequency firms and the exchanges. High-frequency trading requires special access. It requires special nudge deals with the regulator, you know, so they don't get fined into oblivion. It requires a lobbyist. It's not so much the code. It's so much the infrastructure that you have to build around it, and then hope to God you don't, you know, suffer a regulatory breakdown. So I'm all for electronic trading. I would prefer no rules at all, as long as it was equal for everyone. I believe that the smartest guy should win, and the smartest guy shouldn't have to worry about hiring a lobbyist to win. I have a big problem when the rules are not transparent, when the rules clearly say X is illegal, but X is going on all the time. It's hard for smart people to operate in that environment. It's hard for me as a businessman to decide I'm going to support that kind of product, even though I know that is illegal and it should not be. You know, one day, if somebody with ethics ever got into a position of power to regulate it, would shut it down. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to. When the biggest risk is regulatory risk and not market risk, and or the traditional types of risk in this industry, smart people are going to say no.
Okay. So what? Just so we really understand this issue. You know, I know it's a very complex issue, and maybe to get a complete understanding of it might be slightly beyond the scope of this podcast. But what is the big issue? Like, what's the problem with HFT? If you had to like kind of put your finger on it.
Well, okay. So I want to say HFT for the most part is something that exists within the U.S. stock market more than anywhere else. In fact, compared to a central limit order book that you'll find in many other places, including like the CME is a central limit order book, 99% of the issues don't exist. The high-frequency trading in the U.S. stock market exists because the laws of physics and the distances between exchanges and the lack of regulatory oversight and the exchanges allowing or giving these guys faster data feeds. Essentially, Reg NMS was supposed to tie together 10 stock exchanges so that the liquidity would pool together. So before, if you had one exchange trading one stock, all the liquidity would be at that exchange, the central limit order book. They wanted competition, so instead of having one exchange, we'll have multiple exchanges, let's say 10. And the idea was if we tie them all together with the SIP, with consolidated feed, and Reg NMS, which says has this trade-through rule, which if one of those other exchanges has a better price, you can't trade outside of that other exchange. You have to go access that liquidity by those pieces in Reg NMS. The thought was we'll have competition and we'll still have the pooling of all that liquidity together. What HFT does in the U.S. stock market is it guarantees that liquidity is not all pooled together. And once they see executions going off at one of those exchanges, they have faster connections and the ability to race ahead of that executing market order and cancel their orders at the other exchanges and even go in the same direction ahead of those orders, depending on what their statistical models say. So they're, in effect, destroying that liquidity concentration. so that when traders see, oh, there's 20,000 shares of forward offered at the market, even though the 20,000 is 5,000 at NYSE and 6,000 at NASDAQ and 4,000 over at BATS, they're never going to get 20,000. They're going to get a piece of that.
Okay, so one of the counter arguments that you often hear from those who are in favor of HFT, they often say that HFT provides participants with tighter spreads. Is that at all true?
No, it's not true. That's not true. Spreads change within. So, first question I always ask, and I never get an answer, by the way, is how are you measuring your spreads? Are you measuring the widest in a second, the narrowest in a second? Are you aggregating over longer periods of time? Because I can show you thousands and thousands of examples where a stock will move 1% within a second, yet maintain a 1 cent spread during that second. So from one point of view, it's a 1% spread. And another point of way to measure it, it's a 1 cent spread. And I can guarantee you who's going to actually participate in that one, the benefit of the 1 cent spread, and who's going to get reamed on that 1% spread. And it's not going to be the retail investor.
Okay, so are there any other, that's probably the wrong phrasing. Are there any benefits that come from HFTs being active in the marketplace?
Yeah, they push the envelope for transmitting information from point A to point B. In other words, they're providing an incentive for the millimeter microwave dishes to improve, to drop latency, for FPGA cards to be more efficient. I mean, Wall Street has always played a strong role in being on the cutting edge of technology and kind of supported the early engineering efforts at Intel and Dell and Cisco, who, you know, might not have developed really high-tech bleeding-edge kind of things. And so that's one benefit they provide. They certainly do not provide any benefit to somebody trading on the other side of them.
So a term that you often hear associated with HFT is quote stuffing. I know you've mentioned this in the past also, and I think you might have been almost hinting to it a little bit earlier on. Could you explain what is quote stuffing, and has this not always existed on some level?
Well, actually, that's a term that I coined. when we saw, one of the reasons that the SIP got so delayed back in the day was because of the excess traffic on it. Noisy quotes, quote spam, and I remember when Jeff and I were trying to come up with a name for it, I wanted something that was going to be easily Googleable to know that, hey, we created that. And so I don't remember whether it was him or I that came up with it, but quote stuffing is the term we used, and now it's being used everywhere. Quote stuffing is a tool to allow you to slow down another data feed on demand. Like if you want back in the day, if you wanted the NYSE's direct feed to be a little slower, it was a matter of putting X amount of quotes in this inactive symbol, which also is processing the symbols that you were interested in. It was just more network traffic. It was effectively tiny DD, denial of service kind of thing going on. And when you are an internalizer or a wholesaler who is buying and selling on direct feeds, and you're giving the retail customer prices based on the SIP, well, whenever those two are out of sync, it's free money. You buy and sell off the direct feed, you pick out of whatever number you think you can get away with giving the retailer the price for their order, and if those two are out of sync, it's instant money. Because, the regulatory requirement was that you had to be within what the SIP price was showing, and regardless if the SIP was slower or not. So I remember having a discussion with somebody at a big bank, one of these firms, and telling them when I first discovered, hey, you know what? You can actually, I can tell you exactly how you can slow down any one of these feeds. And their reply came back, yeah, we know. We've got these latency tables, dude. I was just like, well, yeah, of course. Then I just sheepishly, grinned to myself. Yeah, you would. It makes total sense. But so, yeah, all the things that we discovered and published, they all knew this was going on. And whatever they called it to slow systems down, I don't know. But that's what code stuffing is all about. And it only really works if you got something that has two data feeds pricing the same thing. So it doesn't. Well, actually, you can actually affect the central limit order books as well, like the CMEs, because you got to remember one machine is going to process more than just one symbol, except for SPY. I mean, the E-mini probably is only processed by one, but there probably are systems there that process like the 10-year note and the 5-year. And so if you like put a load on the 10 or the 5, it's also going to put a load on the other contracts in there, and it could cause an arbitrage situation with the cash market. So it's just putting noise in the system in order to slow it down. And so one of the things you have to do all the time because of that, you have to combat that too, because others are going to do it. You got to maintain your latency tables. You got to know what those limits are. So if the exchange upgrades a network or a machine, all of a sudden that number is different. So you got to know when that changes. And so you're always pinging and testing to see what that limit is. And there's no cost for sending bogus quotes through the system, so why not? And so a lot of the noise that we see is that.
Interesting. Okay. That's a really great answer there, Eric. Thank you very much for digging into that. In various documentaries you've featured in, you've actually described HFT activity as stealing and rigging the market. Do you actually believe that is the case, in a literal sense?
Oh, I have no doubt. No doubt. Anybody who disbelieves, I welcome you to come to my office. I guarantee you after 2 or 3 hours, you will leave changed. In fact, Nate, who works here in the office next to me, always says, every time somebody comes here, when they leave, their mouth is like on the floor, and they're just like you can tell it was information overload. I can show you exactly what's happening. I can show you documentation of the proposals that exchanges have made. I can show you, fines that have come out years later, years after they were denying this stuff ever existed. It's totally rigged.
Okay. Well, I'd love to come by your office sometime if I'm ever in the States there. So I'll keep that in mind. Now, let's get to the bottom of this. So who is the real victim here of HFT? Is it retail traders? Is it longer-term investors? Who's really affected by this?
Everyone. And it's not, the thing is, there's no busload of children going over a cliff. It's just a billion paper cuts suffered by everyone. It's something in the system that doesn't need to be in there. One of the real damaging effects it has is it kills the diversity of participants, where if everything is based on speed and even a little bit of intelligence that takes too long to work out, or you don't have that regulatory advantage, you kind of get sidelined. And so you end up with a market that is just filled with lemming machines that don't have a diversity of opinion and might not, at the moment, do something, when the market is crashing, do something what might look stupid and jump in there and buy. They're not going to do that because they're faster than the other ones. And you end up getting these microstructure, gapes in reality, when all of a sudden, a large cap stock will just suddenly evaporate 5% and then suddenly recover. And, lots of times you look on a chart and you'll see a little spike down, think it was the bad price. And then when you actually dig into it, you see there was 1,000 trades and a penny all the way down, got executed a penny all the way up in a half a second. And then you see that this happens dozens of times a day. And then you see that it's in really big cap stocks. And then you see the SEC, you know, saying, well, people shouldn't use stop orders anymore. And then you think, wait a minute, you know, that's never been a problem in the past. And so it changes the whole way the market is set up to be not really assisting the retail trader. For example, what kind of orders do you have available to you as a retail trader? Buy, sell, market, but I'm not supposed to use those anymore, limit, and stop. And I'm not supposed to use those anymore either. Where's the order that says, I want to buy whenever the market drops, you know, suddenly this much percent at any one of the exchanges, or I want to trade at 9:45 in the morning. Oh, look, I've got surgery scheduled in the morning. I'm not going to be watching the market, and I sure don't want to get eaten alive at the open, but I want to buy at 9:45, you know, a.m., you know, 15 minutes after it opens. And where's that order? Well, I mean, nobody's catering to, you know, the group that's actually getting eaten alive.
Okay. So if this really is such a big issue in the market structure, why have regulators not stepped in and put a complete stop to it? I know there's been fines handed out, you know, here and there, but there's not been a complete stop put in place. Why is this the case?
They're corrupt. And I don't say that lightly. I say that after years of banging my head on it and talking with them and reading documents and calling them out on it and being right. Everything I've published that used to be called a conspiracy nut for has been proven true. I mean, the SEC just gave me a $750,000 whistleblower fine for you know, the discovery I made at the very top of the rabbit hole. These guys are, they're looking for their next job, and they get wined and dined by, you know, these firms. The whole thing with the IEX, for example, them coming in and really promising them their future employment, why would they stick their necks out when they don't have to? There's no bonus check in it for them for doing the right thing.
So in that case, on the other hand, to what extent are the exchanges also responsible for this type of activity that goes on?
They're totally responsible because they're selling these data feeds and they're ensuring that they're faster. It's not, so the law is really clear that you can't provide core data faster on your direct feeds than you provide it to the SIP. And that is what the NYSE got fined $5 million for. And that is what the NYSE swore to me. The CTO of the NYSE, on stage, I was next to him on stage. We were both invited to speak at the TD annual event in Toronto. And it was Larry Leibovitz, who's actually the brother of John Stewart. And he has the gift of talking like his brother does. And he was there on stage painting me as a conspiracy person because I was saying that their feed was slow. And what was really funny about that interaction was I had done the study in July 21st of 2010. This is after the flash crash. And Larry was saying that, oh, there were some system issues, but we got them fixed and everything is fine now. And I was asking him, I said, how long did it take you to fix them? And, well, we had it fixed right away. We saw it and fixed it right away. And I said to him, I said, so it would have been fixed in June. And, yeah, of course, you know, he looks at me like I don't know what I'm talking about. He says, yes. And then I said, well, the study was done in July, and it shows the same thing happening. And that's par for the course. I had a long discussion with the now disgraced Bill O'Brien, you know, the guy who had a little fight or spat with Brad Katsuyama on CNBC who, you know, he argued things with me. He spent the whole afternoon, you know, arguing his point. But it wasn't based on anything concrete or reproducible. It was just based on what he was saying. I mean, they're very smooth talkers, so that talking to a reporter, it's so easy to bamboozle them because it's a very technical thing. And they're, you know, in a position of authority. And I think how this all got this way is in the United States, we give the exchanges, they're self-regulating organizations, SROs, which means that they have legal immunity, which, you know, over the years, if you have legal immunity, which means you can't be sued for, even if you egregiously do something wrong. Well, I know human nature a little bit, and you mix that in with capitalism and having shareholders, legal immunity is just a downward path to the place that we're at today. And that is why.
Yeah, and you make some really great points in there, Eric. And I imagine you'd be a very difficult man to argue with because you have the data. And I mean, at the end of the day, the data does not lie.
Never lost a debate when it comes to data. And I never talk about anything I don't have data on. I mean, if it's not a subject I'm comfortable with or I don't have a data to support it, I'm not going to say anything about it. And so, yeah, so at the end of the day, I never, but, you know, the thing is, it doesn't work for sound bites. It's not a news story. And I can't cut reporters off, access off, where the NYC can or NASDAQ can, and that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, there's such a big difference between fact and opinion. I mean, they're two very different things. So, I mean, just moving on, is HFT here to stay? Like, should we just accept that it's not going anywhere and this is the new market or not so fast?
Well, so I ask you this. Should we accept that a person of integrity and will never get into a position of power at the CFTC or the SEC? You know, somebody who's very knowledgeable and has integrity, if you're telling me that that person will never get in a position of power, then I will tell you that HFT is here to stay. But the day somebody like me gets in there, their days are numbered because you don't have to create any new laws. You don't even have to, you know, try to set precedent. You just go and say, well, we fine that person that much for doing X. You did the same thing for a longer period of time. You get the same punishment. Like, for example, Sarah, who's, you know, facing a lifetime in prison, which, by the way, I think is just a travesty. He's not doing anything different than these guys are doing. And why is he being singled out? I mean, it's wrong. And so if somebody ever gets in a position of power like that, they're in a heap of trouble. So you tell me, is that how society is going to be going forward? Is that what the new thing?
Yeah, well, you do raise an interesting point. I mean, is that something that you would like to step up to if the position was ever available and
I've offered doing it for free. Yep, as long as I've got authority, and I'm not going to, like I said, I'm not going to create any new rules. I'm not going to try to set any new precedents. I'm just going to go through the existing laws and what's already been done and apply them equally and transparently.
Okay. And what sort of response did you get when you offered to do it for free?
Always dead silence. Dead silence.
Right. Okay, Eric. So I just have a couple questions left here. And these questions are mainly based around mini flash crashes. So I think for the most part, listeners are probably familiar with the flash crash that occurred in 2010. I want to ask you about these mini flash crashes that seem to occur more frequently. So I guess, first of all, what is a mini flash crash and how frequently are you seeing these occur?
Well, we define it as something that happens within a second that involves more than 500 trades, that involves price move of several percent. And it always reverses. So there's the crash and then there's the recovery. And the crash involves a frenzy of trading activity. And the recovery involves a lot of activity, though not quite as much as on the way down. they also happen in reverse equally. So you'll get a frenzy to the upside and then the recovery, and this will all happen easily within a second and often involves 1,000 trades and will often involve all 10 exchanges and many dark pools to boot. So this is a phenomenon that did not exist before 2007. After 2007, they started appearing more and more frequently, and we still have them to this day in big cap stocks. Like just today, HOT, large cap stock, hotel, I'm not sure what the name of it is, but the symbol is HOT. It's a hotel and properties company. Just out of the blue, ripped higher and then right back down again. And what's going on is somebody's trying to access the liquidity, gets discovered by one of these high-frequency firms that maybe be a little bit more predatory, sees it, and races ahead to trade in the same direction, knowing that that algorithm that they're using is going to keep going and buying more. And they know that they're the fastest. And so other firms who may not be the fastest, but they know that there are plenty of people slower than them are going to jump on, and so on. Until you've got, you know, the guys at the very end of it who are, you know, the ultimate suckers who are going to end up getting dumped on when the whole thing reverses and comes back the other way. And so what these kinds of events have caused, how it hurts everybody, all the participants, is you really can't have a flat stop order in the market anymore because you're going to get taken out by one of these. And you can't really participate in these because they don't always execute at all exchanges. So in other words, you know, if you were to wanted to place an order to get executed whenever a stock dropped below X amount, they don't always go off at all the 10 exchanges. Sometimes they're confined to a few, especially at that last part of it. And so you're never going to get filled. You can't really participate in them in a way that you can benefit from them, which would in turn prevent them from happening or be as severe. And you're going to end up getting stopped out by them, which means, you know, people are less likely to use stops. So the way that the SEC came around to fixing this was creating this thing called limit up, limit down, which is a very complicated, essentially moving average based on all the trades in the last 5 minutes. And updates in certain way. It doesn't update all the time. There's rules, this, that, with the other rules about them. But they're basically about 5% away from the last price. And so now that those have been rolled out and put in place, we see a lot of these little flash crashes will go within a penny of them and reverse. That's the point that they reverse in price. So they've ended up becoming magnets, so to speak, whereas before, the stock might, drop 2% on one of these. Now they're pretty much guaranteed to go the full 5% and back.
Okay. That's really fascinating. It sounds very complex. It's almost like they've just kind of put a Band-Aid on the issue and not really solved it.
That's exactly what they did, which, kind of came back and bit them on August 24th when... You know, the problem with this is it contains one stock well, if you call, Walmart dropping 5% and back inside of a second, if you call that contained. But when you have multiple stocks doing it and they're members of ETFs or indexes, and one of them is halted and the other one's not, and or five of them are halted and they come out of the halt at various times, it makes it very complicated for the people who are trying to arb at the ETF. And, whenever there's complication or confusion, that instantly results in more volatility and less participation. So you end up with these, with liquidity evaporating at a very quickly. So, I guess I could ask you, where are these tight spreads that are being claimed by these high-frequency firms if we have these mini flash crashes all the time? Dozens and dozens every day occur. So if there truly were providing tighter spreads, you wouldn't have this. We certainly didn't have it before 2007.
Yeah. No, that's wild. Now, from what you see going on a day-to-day basis, What's the likelihood that we could experience something much more significant and damaging than the 2010 flash crash?
Well, August 24th is pretty bad. The Treasury incident back in October of 2014 was pretty bad. The dollar 5% crash 1 year ago today was pretty bad. They keep coming. They're just not being talked about. So that's the solutions. We're just not going to talk about them.
Last question I've got for you, Eric. Now, I know you've been a great supporter of the development of IEX and then potentially becoming a recognized exchange. What's significant about what IEX is doing?
They're people of integrity. Remember I said what will happen when you get somebody of integrity and power? So if the IEX becomes an exchange, they're now SRO, which means they have legal immunity, which, you know, also means that they can see what's going on, and somebody with integrity and power to say, hey, this firm, what you're doing is wrong, and calling them out on it, not having, you know, worry, oh, I can't do that. I can't talk to them and tell them not to do that because they're buying my data feeds, and that's all of our income, and these guys generate all of our income. We can't tell them to stop. You get a person, you get people of integrity with power, and these things will go away. And that's what IEX represents.
Okay, sure. No, good answer. And I'm hoping to have one of the guys from IEX on the podcast sometime soon. So that should be a good discussion too. Well, Eric, let's wrap this up. It's been an eye-opening conversation, that's for sure. I mean, I've really appreciated having you here, and thank you very much for setting aside the time to do this. I know you're a busy man, you've got a lot going on. So, it was really good to speak with you. Where can listeners go to find out more about you?
Our website, nanix.net. It's hard to miss us. Just Google or nanix.net. I frequently post on Twitter under Nanix LLC.
Awesome. Well, I strongly encourage you guys listening to go and follow Eric on Twitter at Nanix LLC. He posts a lot of really great content, very outspoken, and some awesome visualizations, which I get a real kick out of looking at. So, Eric, once again, thank you very much for doing this, man. We'll speak again soon.
Thanks for having me.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders. But rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.